This is Phil Ferrin, and I am driving home, and it's kind of a special edition of the podcast today. See you, sweetie, because I am taking the kiddos home, the grandkiddos home, which means they're in the car with me. They may chime in or not. I don't have any air conditioning. So they are experiencing the glories of my little car without air conditioning. But they're in the back seats, and we'll see if we can make it home successfully and try to do a podcast at the same time. We'll see. Do you know what number of podcasts this is?
No.
It is number. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
434. I know, that's a lot of podcasts. That is over eight years, I think, now. We're the podcast. I have been doing this podcast since before the two of you were born. And someday, you'll have to listen to them all. Cool. We are unimpressed with that idea, I see. Because part of the reason I'm doing these podcasts is so that after I'm dead and gone, you will have something to remember me by. So how about that? You don't look like you're thrilled with the concept of dead and gone, Asher. Anyways, so all is well. We've had an interesting week at work, but everything's puttering along there. We're all fine. We're going to have an exciting day on Monday. Oh, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Going to have an exciting day on Monday because all of our beta testers are coming back from retreat, and which means they're all going to hop in and jam in a bunch of stuff on Monday. And then we're going to have to work through it as fast as we can because we're supposed to compile it all into reports by Tuesday. So, but it'll be fine. One way or another, it'll be fine. Worst case scenario, the stuff doesn't actually get put through till next month. But, you know, life's hard, then you die. In other news, things are just puttering along. We are just taking it one step at a time. With regards to my mom and the nursing home, you know, they are increasing her comfort meds. I'm talking a little louder than I normally do because the windows are down because I don't want the grandkids to get heat stroke. Are you getting heat stroke back there? Is it too much air? What? What? It is the wind. The wind. You can roll the window up a little bit if you want to. Can you reach it? Yep, there you go. Good job. If you get it up just a little bit more, then it won't blow in your face so much. You got it? What do you think? A little more. A little more.
I can't do it.
You can't do it. Let me see. Let me see if I can reach it.
Yes.
How about that? Is that better? Okay, cool. Anyway, so everything's going along with the family. It's fine, it's fine, it's fine. The writing is fine. I still don't know how this book ends, which is kind of interesting because, I mean, as a reader, I would be reading to this point and I would be thinking, how in the world is this going to end? Which, you know, that's not bad. That's not bad. I just have to come up with an ending that then people will say, oh, okay, that makes sense, as opposed to, oh, that was horrible. Because I gotta tell you, my wife and I have finally gotten around to watching season 9 of Doctor Who, and we have not been impressed. We're about halfway through, I think, season 9, and we're just thinking, oh man, where was Stephen Moffat? So I don't know if he got busy or what happened to him, but it has not been great. My son-in-law, my grandchildren's beloved father, assures me that things start hitting their stride by the time we get past the episodes we've gotten past. So there is great hope that season 9 is going to improve. But so far, not so much. So that's the goal with the book, to just try to not be at a not-so-much ending. But I think it's going to be fine. I've got a lot of little ideas. I just don't know which ones are actually going to happen at this point. So anyways, all of that is fine. We're puttering along, and yay! The sun went behind a cloud. So now it's not as warm. We love that. So this week, and obviously this is going to be a shortened podcast, because once I get back to the house, I'm going to have to go ahead and get everybody unloaded. And we're going to make some supper. Going to make some supper. Are you ready for supper? No? Well, I can go down and do some yoga. Or I could bring it upstairs and you could do some yoga with me.
Okay.
You want to try to do some yoga with me? Well, Asher, you could just watch. And then maybe we'll get something to eat afterwards. But anyways, so all is well, things are moving along, it's great. I came across an article, actually it was a TED Talk, TEDx Talk, and, these things are always fascinating to me because, you know, we've talked about the three waves of science before, how the first wave is just observation, the second wave is investigation, and how that in the investigation, the climb of the complexity becomes intimidating, and so people start believing that, well, this all just had to have happened because, you know, the design is so amazing and so overwhelming. And then the farther you get into the design, with the third wave, you get to the point where you're scratching your head and saying, how in the world did this all happen? Well, this scientist is approaching, as far as I can see, this idea of how in the world did this all happen? And the only way they justify it at this point is because there are billions and billions of stars out there and billions of planets. And he freely admits, because it seems oh so improbable for life to have started, that we are probably one of very, very few worlds that have intelligent life on them. Now, of course, if you happen to believe that a designer stuck his finger down in the soup and stirred things up and got things going, then you don't have to be dismayed by how hard it is to get things going, because it got a little boost. So that's what this TED Talk was about. It was called Why We Are Alone in the Galaxy. and it's by Mark Defant, I think is his name. Pretty interesting talk. The guy was talking about the fact that he had written a book, and the more he looked into all of the improbable events that were required to get life started, and then also to get intelligent life here, according to his interpretation of things, of course, the more it seemed like, you know, we're probably it in terms of intelligent life. Which must be a bit discouraging. You know, if you don't believe there's any kind of designer, if you don't believe there's any purpose or meaning to this, because kind of what that means, if you don't believe in all those things, is that we're most likely going to destroy ourselves as we go, and then we will be snuffed out, and no one will ever care. Or no, it'll just, ta-da, be done. But he did raise three interesting points that I had heard some of, but some interesting stuff along the way. So I thought I'd just pass along to you. He was talking about the fact that the search for artificial or for extraterrestrial intelligence. Wow, it's getting really noisy in here. I don't know if you can even hear me. Can you hear me back there?
Yes.
Yes! Well, maybe the microphone can hear me then as well. Looks like Asher is going to sleep. So he was saying that we've been working on SETI now for 50 plus years. Haven't really found anything on the search for extra intestinal life. Extraterrestrial intelligence. And he kind of thinks he knows why. Because the more he studied, the more he realizes how many pieces actually have to come together to make this all work, in his viewpoint. And that is very true. And in fact, he talked about in this TED Talk, he said, now there are literally hundreds of things that had to come together for us to be where we are right now. If you believe in a completely random environment, which of course I don't, but we'll go with his premise for a moment. So if you believe in a completely random environment, there are hundreds of things that have to come together. There are so many things that have to come together that it strains credulity. And the only way to solve it, as I said, would be to have a near infinite number of planets and then just say, well, we just happen to be the one where everything got together and worked. Which that's fine if that's what he wants to believe, but he highlighted three things that were pretty interesting. He talked first of all about the fact that you have to have more than just a Big Bang to get the universe started. Because in the Big Bang, all you end up with is, according to the theories, is hydrogen and helium. You don't have any of the other elements that you need to make life possible. It's just hydrogen and helium floating through the universe. So the first thing that has to happen is that has to condense down into large stars. They have to be large stars. And they have to burn for billions of years, because in the process of burning for billions of years, they convert that hydrogen to helium, and then helium to carbon, I think, and then carbon to something else. And eventually, you get most of the elements, and then those elements are exploded out in a supernova. Then the next thing that has to happen is those elements have to go out and seed in just the right amount in nearby nebula of hydrogen and helium. And then there has to be another supernova that explodes at just the right distance to condense down the smaller clouds so that you can actually have planets forming with a central star that's hot enough, but not too hot, and planets forming that are close enough, but not too close, to the star to end up with something that actually has water, according to the prevailing theories. And of course, all of this has to be finely tuned. Because you can end up with a star with a bunch of rocky planets and a bunch of gas giants rotating around, as we have seen from the Kepler observatories and the predictions of planets. But you still have to get to a planet with water, according to the first theory. So you gotta have all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, you have to have the very fortuitous event of life actually starting without a designer, but that's a whole other story. So that was his first thing. This very finely tuned sequence of events. You gotta have a supernova at just the right distance to explode, to send out all of these different elements so that they can seed a nearby nebula cloud without dispersing it. Then you've gotta have another supernova that goes off to actually condense close enough that there's enough force that it condenses that cloud and actually gets a star going. That's the first thing. Second thing is according to all the scientists and their theories, the dinosaurs ruled the Earth for many years and actually ruled supreme. that they would have still been alive today if you didn't have a meteor that was just exactly the right size hit us. Because it needed to be just the right size to knock out all the dinosaurs. But not so big that it killed off all life on the planet. And not so small that it didn't kill off all the dinosaurs. So that's his second big thing. And he said, and scientists have estimated that this meteorite, whatever we're going to call it, was about 10 kilometers in diameter. Too much larger, no life on the planet at all. Too much smaller, the dinosaurs don't get killed off, the mammals don't have a chance to rise. Then the third big thing that he noted, aside from all the other extremely fortuitous events that you would need to happen, the third big thing that he noted was that you've got to have arid conditions occur where all the big primates are. Because according to his theories, what had to happen is you had to have these big primates who swung through the trees, who from that developed larger brains, and then were forced out of the trees, and they had those larger brains to help them as they hunted and as they went across the savannas and moved out. And this, in fact, the East African Rift Valley at one point did have a bunch of trees in it, and that was where I think we've lost Asher. Completely we've lost Asher. Does he normally lay down to the side like that, Clara?
Yeah.
Okay, then we're okay. I'm just going to get the... We're almost home. We'll get inside. We'll get in where it's nice and cool. Hopefully. So his last big thing is that you not only need life to form, you not only need dinosaurs to get killed off, you not only need mammals to form, you also need big primates to form, swinging specifically through trees, according to him. And then, after you have all of that, you've got to get them driven out of the trees so that they use their big brains for something else besides just swinging through the trees. Of course, these are all very fortuitous events. And, you know, that part of it's pretty interesting. I don't know that we really know all the different things that actually happened and what the sequence was, but it's all very fortuitous, and it strains credulity that in fact all of this stuff could have happened by itself unless there was some sort of designer watching over it. But of course he doesn't have that, so he just has to say, well, the only reliance we have that this actually all happened was because we have billions and billions of planets. And if he wants to go that direction, that's fine, but I just have a sneaking suspicion that at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, and somebody actually runs the numbers on all of this, they're going to find that it doesn't matter how many planets you have, all of this stuff just simply could not have lined up, and that will get us to the third wave. Anyways, it's very warm outside. I got grandkids I got to get inside. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.